WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Kansas City bluesman Jay McShann. The pianist and bandleader has won a Pioneer Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. We'll listen back to a 1987 concert with him. Also, actor Danny Aiello. He starred in the movies Moonstruck, Do the Right Thing, and Ruby. He's currently in the film City Hall with Al Pacino and John Cusack. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the television version of Neil Simon's play Jake's Women, and film critic John Powers reviews Up Close and Personal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton is cutting off most U.S. aid to Colombia. Officials say he's determined that Colombia has failed to cooperate fully with the war on drugs. The move follows accusations that Colombia's president solicited funds from drug lords during his 1994 election campaign. The president met with a small group of parents today, seeking their views on yesterday's announcement that TV executives have decided on a voluntary system to rate television programs for sex and violence. The president said he'll seek input from parents on what works and what doesn't work. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Mr. Clinton and some local parents spent an hour in what Press Secretary Mike McCurry jokingly described as a blatant attempt to keep reports on yesterday's session with media executives going for another news cycle. All those who took part in the session expressed support for so-called V-chip technology and the program rating system promised by the television industry, although Virginia resident Tom Murphy warned against going overboard.
This is not the silver bullet that's going to end everything. This is just one more tool that we've got to work with.
President Clinton echoed Tom Murphy's sentiments, saying new technologies and rating systems are useless unless parents actually use them. Bill Small at the White House.
The White House says the president has approved a U.S. visa for IRA ally Jerry Adams. The visa will allow Adams to spend his second St. Patrick's Day in the United States. Administration officials say the president has approved a 3-month single-entry visa, and Adams has agreed not to raise money for the IRA during his visit. After campaigning heavily for tomorrow's South Carolina primary, Senator Bob Dole has moved to New England. Connecticut is one of 5 New England states in Tuesday's so-called Yankee primary. Connecticut Public Radio's John Danofsky reports.
Senator Dole's rally took place right across from the state capitol in Hartford and featured Governor John Rowland as host. Dole is the first candidate to come through Connecticut, and he used the opportunity to attack his main opponents on economic issues vital to Connecticut's struggling economy. First, Pat Buchanan for his opposition to GATT and NAFTA, and then Steve Forbes for his flat tax, and then offered his own proposal.
Jack Kemp, who many of you know, many supported in 1988, was the chairman of an economic growth and tax reform commission. We're looking at a single rate concept, but one thing we want to keep for a lot of people in this audience is your mortgage interest deduction. That's the only tax break many Americans have.
Dole has strong support from Connecticut's Republican Party and seems well-positioned for the state's 27 delegates in the winner-take-all primary. For National Public Radio, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 27.5 points at this hour. It stands at 5513.08. Trading has been heavy so far today. 384 million shares have changed hands. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Dr. Jack Kevorkian took the stand in his own defense at his trial in Michigan's former assisted suicide law in Pontiac, Michigan today. Kevorkian told the jury he tries to talk his sickly patients out of suicide and said he turns down many patients who come to him. He's being charged in the deaths of 2 elderly people and could face 4 years in prison on each charge if found guilty. Former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev confirmed today that he plans to run in Russia's June presidential elections. NPR's Anne Gerrels reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's announcement today was no surprise. He'd already said he was 100% sure he would run, but kept putting off the public announcement, which caused more yawns than ripples in Russia's political circles. With a public opinion rating of less than 1%, the former Soviet president isn't likely to steal votes from any of the other contenders. The main question is why Mikhail Gorbachev thinks it's worth running at all. Asked what are Gorbachev's chances of coming in even second or third, a sociologist tracking the election said flatly, none. Still a celebrity in the West for helping to end the Cold War, at home, Gorbachev gets grudging respect at best. Most criticize him either for moving too slowly or causing the breakup of the Soviet Union. While Gorbachev clearly believes he still has a role to play, Russians have long relegated him to history. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
The Clinton administration is warning American civilian pilots to stay out of Cuban airspace during a memorial service off Cuba's coast tomorrow. It's also warning the Castro government not to interfere with the memorial. Cuban exiles plan to hold the service tomorrow afternoon to honor 4 companions who died when their planes were shot down last weekend by Cuban fighter jets. The FAA told the civilian pilots last night that if they violate Cuban airspace, they will lose their license, have their planes seized, and may be fined or jailed. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a concert with Jay McShann, the last of the great Kansas City pianists and band leaders. Last night, he received a Pioneer Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. The foundation works for wider recognition and financial support for R&B artists of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Jay McShann grew up in Oklahoma and came to Kansas City in 1937 when it was the capital for boogie-woogie, blues, and swing. In Kansas City, he assembled his now legendary big band. Some of his sidemen included bassist Gene Ramey, drummer Gus Johnson, and blues shouters Joe Turner and Walter Brown. But his most remarkable find was Charlie Parker, who made his recording debut with McShann. The big band split up during World War II when McShann and most of his musicians were drafted. The jazz scene changed after the war, and listeners lost track of Jay McShann. The 70s brought a resurgence of interest in the Kansas City style, and since then, McShann's made many solo and small group recordings. Jay McShann celebrated his 80th birthday in January and continues to perform. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1987.
Jay McShann, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Taryn. It's a pleasure to be here.
If I may, can I make a request for the opening? Could you open with one of the songs that you wrote and that is named after you, Hootie Blues?
Be glad to. Me. Hello, little girl, don't you remember me? Now the time ain't been so long, but I had a little break, you see. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, she lives three flights out, and she sends me with a smile. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. She calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Ain't you.
That sounds absolutely terrific. My guest is Jay McShann at the piano. Can we go back to around the period when that tune was written, back to the 1930s when you came to Kansas City and started putting your big band together? Kansas City was a real mecca for jazz then. What were your first impressions when you got there?
Well, my first impression was I was excited and seeing all this happening and guys like Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, playing all the boogie-woogie. Joe Turner singing blues right off the top of his head, you know, he'd make up words as he'd go along. And all these musicians were playing all this swing music, you know, and musicians from north, east, south, and west, and it was excitable. It was exciting.
How did you decide to put together a big band? How did you go about starting to do that?
Well, what happened, we had a small group at first, I imagine about four, five, sometimes six pieces. And then we got a job to play for Walkathon. And that required about 12, 13-piece band, big band. And so we took this job. And so quite naturally we had to have a big band. And the walk-along lasted about 4 months. And so during the 4 months, that's how we got our book together and then got the band together so fast.
What would you do to go recruit musicians? Where would you go to hear who the best musicians were?
Well, the way I did, I even went up to Omaha. And at that time, Nat Towles had one of the finest bands in the country. And I went up to listen to some of his musicians play. And when I left Omaha, I left there with about four of them.
Was that considered bad form to steal musicians from somebody else's band?
Well, no, it's not bad form as long as, you know, if they owe the band leader, then you give them the money to pay the band leader and bring them on. Really, it's nice, much nicer for them to give a notice, you know, but, you know, guys do things like that.
Probably the greatest discovery you made was finding Charlie Parker and getting him into your band. How did you decide to recruit him?
Well, I just happened to be passing through the streets one night, and they'd piped all the music out in Kansas City, and I heard this particular sound, and so I went in to see who it was, and then so we met and we talked, and he told me he'd been out of town because I thought I hadn't been in Kansas City very long, and I thought I'd met most of the musicians. So he said he'd been down in the Ozarks with George Lee's band, and it's hard to get musicians to go down there because it's so dead, you know, and like, cats like to be around where the happenings is, you know. And so he said he wanted to do a little woodshedding, so he went down there with George's band.
And then you got him in your band. Was Jumpin' Blues, I think, did you co-write that with him, Jumpin' the Blues?
Yes, we did.
Could you play it for us?
Okay.
This is a song that my guest Jay McShann co-wrote with Charlie Parker. Jumpin' the Blues, played by my guest, Jay McShann. Let's talk some more about the big band for a little while. It's such a big responsibility to hold a band together and to make sure all the players show up on time and that they're there when you're ready to travel and everything. Did you enjoy that part of it?
Well, that was quite a responsibility. But we made it easier, I guess, because, all the guys are young and crazy.
I'm sure.
I think the way you did it, since everybody was crazy, you did a lot of crazy delegating, you know. And like some guys, Gene Ramey, he would always look out for a couple, three of the guys. And I could count on Bob Maybane keeping a couple, three guys straight, you know. And I liked that, and it was no problem.
Around during the war, you were drafted. right?
That's true.
A lot of guys in the band were drafted. Did you realize that that was going to be the end of the band?
Well, no, I didn't have any idea that would be the end of the band, because at the time we were booked about a couple of years ahead, and we were really stretched out. But they had been trying to catch up with me, and we was on the road traveling. They couldn't find me, so we played a one-night stand, and so then they took me right on to Leavenworth after that, doing intermission.
Huh. What happened after the war when your big band had split up? What did you decide to do? Where did you go?
Well, after the war, you know, most of the dance halls were made into
clubs.
Most of the dance halls, you know, were made where they, you know, throw these balls.
Bowling alleys.
Bowling alleys. Yeah, I couldn't even think of it, and then it was quite expensive to move a big band then.
Yeah.
But it has gotten quite expensive, and then people were buying combos, smaller groups, 4, 5, and 6-piece groups.
So where did you go? Did you go back to Kansas City?
Yes, I went back to Kansas City, and then I tried the big band again, but it wasn't going to work. It didn't work.
Because of financial reasons?
That's right. Yeah, financial reasons were just too outlandish.
I think a lot of people lost track of where you were when you went to Kansas City. Did that bother you?
No, it didn't. You see, because my kids at that time, see, they were getting around school age, and I knew I had to pick out some place for them to go to school. And so I decided to go back to Kansas City.
It's difficult to have a family when you're on the road all the time.
Yes, it is. And so I came off the road, but I worked around Kansas City, maybe within the radius of, 600-700 miles, and in Kansas City, you know. Continued to play, but I didn't get out and stay out on the road, you know, like, until after they finished high school.
So what kind of places were you playing when you returned?
Oh, it was nightclubs and, you know, yeah, nightclubs and so forth.
Playing the same kinds of songs you played with the band, but with
primarily the same songs, but, you know, with smaller groups, sometimes we'd have a trio, sometimes maybe we'd have a quartet, you know, whatever the gig called for. We had to kind of, you know, go lean with the gig, whatever was happening.
My guest is the great Kansas City pianist, Jay McShann. And we're going to take a short break, then he's going to play some more, we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Jay McShann, can I ask you to play something else for us? How about a standard? This isn't the kind of thing you used to play back in the old days.
Okay. And when I grow too old to dream. Your love will be in my heart. So kiss me, oh, kiss me, my sweet. And now let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, well, your love will be in my heart. Kiss me, oh, kiss me, my sweet. And now, oh, let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, your love will be in my heart. Well, your love will be in my heart. When your love will be in my heart.
A beautiful version of that. You didn't really sing too much, at least not on your records, when you had your big band, and the singers were Walter Brown, Big Joe Turner, Al Hibbler sometimes sang with you. How come you never got to sing yourself very much? Or maybe you did in concerts, which I wasn't around for.
No, I didn't. I wasn't. I didn't do any singing. In fact, I didn't do any singing at all. And I always felt that, you know, with the big band, you always, you wanted good singers.
Wait a minute. You were so, implying that you were not a good singer.
But then after the war, you know, then I couldn't afford the good singers, and so I had to, you know, people would come up and ask for tunes, and they said, well, we want somebody to sing it, and so then I had to sing it, you know. So that's why I started.
So you don't think of yourself as a singer?
No.
Well, you don't have the kind of really big shouter type voice, but I really do love your voice very much. Did you have to, were you self-conscious at first when you started to sing?
Well, I guess it does kind of work on you to a certain extent, because you don't want to, I didn't want to do it, you know. But then after you started doing it, you know, well, then it just comes in just like you're playing, you know.
Can I ask you how you started to play piano, how you first started to learn the instrument?
Well, you know, when you're in school, your parent, the band, the guy got the band at school, you know, he wants you to get an instrument and play an instrument, you know. And my folks was too poor to buy me an instrument. And I wanted to either play trumpet or sax or clarinet. But they didn't have the money, and so consequently I couldn't get no horn to play. So we had a beat-up Kimball piano there, so I just started fooling around on the piano.
And then you left home when you were pretty young to try to make it?
Yes, yes. I guess I left home around 16, something like that.
Did you play in a lot of other people's bands before you got your own?
Yes,
together?
I played with Al Denny, who was one of the first big bands I'd ever played with in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I also played with the Gray Brothers. They had a small group, and that was the beginning.
I think we can all hear your piano style a lot more now, too. Now that you're playing in small groups and playing solo, you can hear a pianist in a way that you can't when they're in a big band.
Well, you know, when I had a big band, I always felt like that we had all those horns up there, and I always wanted everybody to work. You know, I wanted to hear everybody working, because it used to bug me to see maybe three-fourths of the guys standing up holding their horns, you know. That always, you know, and I always like to see them busy all the time, an ensemble or something going all the time, you know, with the big band. And so they always told me, though, I should have taken more solos, but I always liked that ensemble.
I just one last thing. You know, I've been calling you the last of the great Kansas City pianists, and it's It must be something you think about a lot, to be a survivor like that.
Well, I enjoyed playing music, and it's always good to be a survivor.
Terry Gross spoke with Jay McShann in 1987. Last night, he won a Pioneer Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. Jay McShann's latest recordings include Some Blues on Chascoro Records and Just a Lucky So-and-So on Sackville Records. He was also the focus of the documentary film The Last of the Blue Devils. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk about acting and hard times with Danny Aiello. He played the pizzeria owner in Do the Right Thing and shares intended in Moonstruck. He's now in the new film City Hall. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews a new television version of Neil Simon's play Jake's Women. And John Powers reviews the new film Up Close and Personal. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. This Sunday night, CBS presents Neil Simon's Jake's Women, a new TV version of his stage play, with Alan Alda again playing the role of Jake. TV critic David Bianculli has this preview.
CBS has been really sneaky about its on-air promotions for Jake's Women. The promos make a big deal out of Alan Alda as the star, which is fair. The promos also show him surrounded by and interacting with a bunch of female co-stars, including Mira Sorvino from Mighty Aphrodite and Ann Archer from Fatal Attraction. But what the promos don't tell you is that most of the women in Neil Simon's Jake's Women exist primarily in Jake's imagination. Jake is an author who can't stop daydreaming. So even though his first wife, played by Mira Sorvino, has been dead for years, he still visits her in the past or allows her to visit him in the present. And even though his second wife, played by Ann Archer, has separated from him, she's still around too, at least in Jake's mind. And so are Jake's sister and his analyst and his daughter, whom Jake conjures up at two different ages, as a cute young kid and at her current age as a young adult. You can almost see why CBS wanted to shy away from this stuff in the promos. It's confusing, it's hard to describe, It takes some getting used to, and not all the jokes and scenes work smoothly. Certainly, most of the critical reaction to this telemovie version of Simon's Broadway play has been mixed to poor. And the fact that CBS saved Jake's Women until after the February rating sweeps means that the network has little faith in it. But there's something really powerful at the center of Jake's Women for those who have the patience to sit still and let it unfold. The performances are strong, and the drama really kicks in when Jake finally gets the chance to explain why it is he's so haunted by the past. The scene occurs when Mira Sorvino, as Jake's long-dead wife, persuades Jake to let her visit with her now-grown daughter, played by Kimberly Williams. Jake imagines their reunion and watches tearfully as it plays itself out.
What was the best thing we ever did together, just you and me?
Oh, gosh. So many things. I think mostly when I'd get sick and you'd crawl into bed with me and read books to me.
I still know Bambi by heart.
And when we were in that hotel in Atlantic City and you let me call room service and order my own dinner.
Right, and then when I got out of the shower, I found 2 chocolate sundaes and a double cheese pizza.
Haven't we all done this? Who hasn't thought about what it would be like to speak to a father or a mother who died 5 or 20 years ago? Would your mother still be proud of you? Would you still be your father's little girl? We've all played out that scene. My problem is I never stopped doing it.
The other scene stealers in Jake's Women are Ann Archer and Lolita Davidovich, both of whom display usually hidden comic talents, and Julie Kavner, who's always good. Some scenes are too shrill, and sometimes the dialogue is too obvious. But all in all, spending time with Jake's Women is a wholly justifiable diversion for the audience as well as for Jake.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Our guest, Danny Aiello, stars in the new movie, City Hall. He plays Frank Anselmo, a county Democratic Party leader. In this scene, Aiello has a confrontation with the mayor of New York, played by Al Pacino.
Speaking of performances, Frank, I don't want to hear about another one like that one you gave this morning.
Your boy embarrassed me.
You're going to have to live with it.
Why?
Because he's my boy. There's oil under that vacant lot, Frank. Jobs.
You don't need to politic me. I run Kings County.
Jobs for people of the city, Frank. Not leases for Lenny Lasker, Murray Sapphire, and all your greedy pals.
Hey, what's happened to you, John? Just because this kid thinks he can elect you president, you're going to forget who got you here?
I don't forget anything. You're developing a short memory, Frank, or a very selective one. You want me to refresh it for you?
I'm sorry, John.
Danny Aiello is a great actor with no formal training, but he has plenty of what's called life experience. He used to work for Greyhound Bus and was the president of the union local. After a dispute with management, he was out of a job, and when he needed money real bad, he stole it. Then he worked as a bouncer at several clubs. He didn't start acting until his mid-30s. He got his breaks in the films Purple Rose of Cairo as Mia Farrow's husband, in Moonstruck as Cher's intended, and in Do the Right Thing as Sal, the owner of the pizzeria. He also played the title role in the film Ruby, about Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. Terry Gross spoke with Danny Aiello in 1992 about that film. He told Terry that he remembered watching Ruby shoot Oswald on live TV.
I went, yip, yip, hooray. I believed at that time, Terry, in street justice, an eye for an eye. He killed our president, and this guy killed him. Good. That's how I felt. And this, of course, was the germ of the idea where I began to formulate the character of Ruby. I made him in my own mind a hero. And as we know, the way Ruby ends up, we find out that he's really not a hero, and he's realizing it toward the end of his life. But that was my reaction.
When did you stop thinking hip, hip, hooray?
Well, because I still have a feeling about Ruby. I feel that he murdered this guy, but I truly feel that he was a victim as well of the kind of a person he was. He was a very ingratiating person. He was a chameleon kind of person. He was a person who brushed shoulders with many, many kinds of people. And whenever he did that, assuming that it was a wise guy, he would attempt to take on the persona of a wise guy. If he was on a stage introducing an act, he suddenly became Dale Carnegie with a southern twinge in his voice, therefore placating his audience. And if he was with an intellectual, he would become or attempt to become that kind of a person. He was a person that was looking for acceptance all of his life, I feel. And through my investigation of the character and a little that there was on Ruby, I formulated this kind of character, which I thought would be complex and very nice to do. He never left me. He has never left me. The word hero might not be the correct one, but he's never left me as a guy who did what he had to do. The reason, if I do call him a hero and feel that he was a hero, I don't know exactly when I stopped feeling that way. I don't know if I entirely have stopped feeling that way. But he was a guy who did something he felt, in my opinion, was patriotic. He did something which he felt was going to uplift his race of people, which are Jewish people. This is what I feel. He did something that he thought was heroic, only later to find out that people didn't think he was a hero. He thought they stole from the American people. He stole from the American people the opportunity of finding out what actually did happen. And as a result of that, they felt that he was a conspirator. And I think from that point on was when his downfall was, and he slowly died from then on.
You portray Ruby as a small-time guy who's gotten in over his head.
Absolutely.
And who often has to bluff his way out of tight situations. And you do wonderful line readings in the movie. I mean, I think you just convey a lot with your voice and with where you put the accents in certain readings of lines. I wonder how you rehearse these things, even at home. And I don't even necessarily mean on the set, but when you got this script and you were trying to figure out how you would do the character, how you would do specific lines, what's your process like for testing out your line reading?
I wish I had a process. I do it until I learn it, and I don't learn it. I'm talking about line by line by line. I don't memorize it to the extent where it's like rote. It's always got to be fresh and new to me. I like to go before the cameras knowing the lines, but I'm not totally sure of them. Do you follow what I mean? So that when they do come out of my mouth, they appear to be coming out of my mouth for the first time. I don't know what the system is. People at the American Academy asked me to come over and teach. I said, what am I going to teach? They said, the ILO system. I said, what is that? I have no way of defining it. All I know is I sit by myself with myself. I work on the script, and it's a matter of repetition, constantly going over the entire script, interrelating with other characters, what other characters mean to me. And then I find, after making all the plans that I can, when I'm finally going before the cameras opposite the other actor, things change. And they all start all over again, and it's probably nothing that I've been rehearsing. But I like to go in there with that feeling that I'm not quite sure what all the lines are, so that it comes out not like rote, as I said before.
You know, one of your really big breakthrough roles was as Sal in Do the Right Thing. And I really loved you in that film, and I always felt watching that movie that Spike Lee probably saw the character as a blatant racist, but that you gave the character a depth and integrity. And I know you actually even wrote lines for the character to flesh the character out. But it was as if Spike Lee didn't notice that the character had changed by virtue of your interpretation of it. And so in the meantime, all the plot was proceeding as if you were this one-dimensional racist, when in fact the character you were playing was no longer that.
Yeah, if you pick up his original script, the original, you'll see that he was a one-note character. To me, he was what I would have called in the old days a token black in an all-white film. In this case, he could have been a token white in an all-black film. When I looked at it, I told Spike, I said, Spike, I said, this guy's a plantation owner. This guy's a boring character. Why is he there? Why is he in Bed-Stuy? Why has he got a pizzeria? And in a totally black neighborhood. I said, he can be anywhere. So I defined in my own mind that he's there because that's where he wants to be. He likes the people. He enjoys the people he's working with. He saw them get older. He enjoys the fact that they love his food. He's that kind of a simple guy, and it was because of that, I think, that made the character a more sympathetic character, and they're a multi-dimension character, as opposed to a simple out-and-out racist. Now, you may define in your own mind or come to the conclusion that Sal is a racist, but it's not obvious.
But do you think that Spike Lee maybe didn't even notice how the character was changing? In other words, I always felt that the movie proceeded, the plot proceeded as if some of the people were acting to you like you were this just one-note racist, which the character no longer was.
Well, that may be the ability to people to either respond as actors or not be able to respond to what it is they're hearing. You know what I mean? With Spike, I have to give him this. Before I agreed to do this, I said I wanted to make some changes. He said, anything you want to do to make it better. That's what Spike said. And he went with the program as we were going. See, there was one part of the film at the end where it bothered me that Spike's character, Mookie, said to Sal, my character, what are you arguing about after the place was burned down? You're going to get your money back on insurance. I was infuriated by that remark because you cannot, as a store owner, as a business owner in Bed-Stuy, get insurance. So I said, this is a joke. Why are you saying that? I said, I want to come back. Well, what are you kidding? I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. He didn't want that line in. So I had to write this other line. This isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Do you remember that line? So he compromised somewhat. He didn't want me to say I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. But he did permit me to say, this isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Anything anyone ever tells me could never make me believe that Sal was an out-and-out racist. What Sal is a realist. If a man, forgive my language, or anyone who may be offended, looks at Sal and calls him a guinea, Sal will in kind come back and call you a nigger, a spick, a mick, a kite. Do you follow what I'm saying? He would go to the core of trying to hurt that person as that person just tried to hurt him. That's the honesty of Sal.
Actor Danny Aiello speaking with Terry Gross. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with actor Danny Aiello.
You started acting when you were in your mid-30s. Did you have any idea before that you were even interested in acting?
No, I gravitated toward acting, Terry, because I thought it might be, it's a communication media, and I was a fairly good talker, and I was fairly good with people, that maybe this would be the way to go. I was uneducated. I was in high school for about a half hour. I went in one door and out the other. I went to James Monroe. So I really had no education, no trade. So I felt that the obvious place to go after losing the union job would be into acting, never realizing how difficult that profession is. But I did it anyway. But I never thought I would be a failure. I always thought to some level I would be a success if I dedicated myself. And look what happened, you know.
I'm interested in your early life. Your father was a teamster and was on the road a lot.
Yeah, my father was not home. We had what could be perceived as a fatherless home.
Right.
Amanda would come home once a year, impregnate my mother, have a steak while we all ate macaronis and beans. But Mama managed to find a steak for him somehow, and he ate it. He ate it very proudly at the table while we ate macaroni and beans. But it was my mother who was solely responsible for the bringing up of 7 children.
I know you went to work when you were very young, but I think you also got involved in robberies when you were pretty young,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did some crazy things. I had a fear, Terry, of being homeless, And that was early on. I don't know when that was put in my mind. I guess maybe if Mama decided to run off like Dad did, then the 7 kids would have been homeless.
So I guess that was the germ of the idea in my mind. And as I grew up and I lost my union presidency job, and there was very little for me to, you know, I was making 190 a year, then I was making nothing. I got frightened, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to keep a roof over the heads of my four children and my wife and myself. And I did things to compensate for that. And they were not armed robberies. They were not hitting people over the head. They were some maybe deserted buildings where there might be a safe. I did some silly, stupid things that I feel ashamed I did. And I hate to even talk about them in public because it sends out mixed signals. It's like the dope addict who says, look, you kids can don't start dope, you know. But he's telling a kid not to start dope when he was a dope addict and is now telling people he got off of it and he's a famous person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
So I don't like to send out those messages, but the fact is that was my life. And I try to justify it by saying, you know, I was desperate. I thought we were going to be homeless, and that was the only way I can turn. Because at that point in my life, it was pretty hard for me to have no money coming in and supporting a family of six, four children, my wife and I.
Did you make sure the statute of limitations was up before mentioning
it
publicly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. What a wise son of a gun I am, but I did. And, you know, I don't want you to think that it was like this was an ongoing thing forever. It was a thing that happened until the fear became so great in me that I said, I just can't do this, because what I would be doing is losing my family anyway if I did have to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And things, just as God wants, started to work out. See, I had the problem, I never wanted to borrow money from anyone. I wouldn't take money, I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't accept help from anyone. And the only help that I did accept was something that really set me off to stealing, and that was welfare. I didn't have the guts to go into the welfare office. My wife did. We were twice on welfare for 2 months. My wife stood in line, humiliated, right? And she came from a family that had money. She was humiliated, and she stood there. And I swore I would never do that again. So when we started to get destitute again, I refused to go back there. So the next thing that I did was decide to make money in another way. Sandy had no idea I did it. She thought I was hustling pool again, because I was an expert pool shooter, billiard shooter at the early time of my life. So I was telling Sandy lies as to where I was getting the rent money. There were times that I was 4 or 5 months behind in my rent. And I was afraid we were going to be homeless again, so I would go out and do something, and I'd break into cigarette machines, jukeboxes. I used to pay rent with quarters and nickels and dimes. It's crazy, and I'm ashamed to tell you this, Terry, and I don't want you to think any less of me for it, but I'll tell you, people do that, and we can be critical and should be critical, because no one should have to do that. But sometimes you get so desperate and you have no one to turn to ask the advice, and you go out and do it.
So what was the job that got you out of this?
Well, the acting started to come more and more, and I started bouncing in Roseland, and I took other bouncing jobs to supplement my earnings. Then, of course, the improvisation again. Then I began getting Broadway shows, acting jobs. Remember, the first acting jobs I got were on a stage, and they were off Broadway. They were so off, it was like in a Bronx somewhere. And they were paying very, very little money, if not any money at all, you know. They were like Equity Productions, 13 performances. The fortunate thing is a writer by the name of Louis LaRusso had written me 3 off-Broadway plays. And I gave back his audition, and each one of those plays, I took to Broadway and starred in each of them.
Terry Gross spoke with Danny Aiello in 1992. Danny Aiello stars now in the new movie City Hall with Al Pacino and John Cusack.
Thank you.
music from the film soundtrack of Do the Right Thing. Coming up, a review of Up Close and Personal. This is Fresh Air. Hollywood doesn't turn out star vehicles the way it once did, but a new movie starring Robert Redford and Michelle Pfeiffer is just that. Film critic John Powers has a review of Up Close and Personal.
The term up close and personal hit it big about 20 years ago, when one of the networks used it to introduce its profiles of Olympic athletes. If you saw those segments, you'll remember that they were always glib and squeaky clean. No matter what tragedy had befallen an athlete, the story was always suspiciously upbeat. Which makes it fitting that Up Close and Personal should now be the title of a breezy new movie about a TV reporter, played by Michelle Pfeiffer. The movie tells the rags-to-riches story of Tally Atwater, a trailer park gal from Reno, Nevada, who dreams of being a star. Using a fake audition tape, she lands a small job at a TV station in Miami. And there, she finds herself working for Warren Justice, a one-time network correspondent played by Robert Redford. Justice's career is on the skids because he won't treat news as entertainment. In the opening scenes, Tally comes off as one daffy chick, with a bad perm and the klutziness of Jim Carrey. She's always stumbling or spilling her purse all over the floor. But even as Justice patronizes her, he sees her potential. "She eats the lens," he declares grandly, and begins playing Professor Henry Higgins to her Eliza Doolittle. He brings out her hidden talents, like the time he coaches her through a live broadcast about the drowning of two Colombians.
In the blue water off Miami today.
Miami Beach today. Raul Soto, Domingo Katz, what do they dive for? What do they want?
In the blue water off Miami Beach today, divers are still...
Hold the divers. Lead with Raul Soto and Domingo Katz. I'll tell you what to say.
I know what to say.
Well, then say it.
Raul Soto and Domingo Katz.
25 feet from the big enchilada. 25 feet from the promised land. 25 feet from walking down Collins Avenue in a job bussing dishes at the Blue. Do you have any idea what it's like to want something that bad?
10 seconds, Warren.
Answer me, do you?
Yes.
Then show me.
Rob can't stretch. She's on in 7 seconds. Six.
Tell me a story.
Four. Three. Two.
Two men drowned today off Miami Beach. Raul Soto and Domingo Katz did not belong in the luxurious cabanas that line this stretch of the beach. They jumped ship. They wanted to come to America, and they died. 25 feet from what they must have seen as the promised land.
By Jove, I think she's got it. But as Tally moves on to bigger things, her story stops being Pygmalion and becomes a newsroom version of A Star is Born, the old Hollywood chestnut about the wrenching romance between a rising actress and an actor on his way down. And it's as a love story that Up Close and Personal is most enjoyable. There are worse ways to spend an evening than watching incredibly attractive performers move from verbal sparring to passionate kisses. Pfeiffer and Redford glide through their roles, exuding the sexual confidence of stars who know they look better than we ever could. They both eat the lens. But the movie isn't content to be merely a love story. The script was written by Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn, two literary big shots who want to attack the mindlessness of media culture. The only problem is, the movie's every bit as fluffy as the newscast it's mocking. Although Tally is supposed to be burning with ambition, she has none of the edgy, driven selfishness you actually find in People on the Make. Always a nice girl, she rises to the top of a dirty business without betraying a single ideal. Mary Tyler Moore faced darker nights of the soul when she worked for Mr. Grant. And Warren Justice is even more idealized. In the original A Star is Born, the hero's career is failing because he's a drunk. Nothing so downbeat here. Justice's only flaw is having too much wisdom and integrity. He's like God, only blonder. Hollywood has made a lot of movies about TV news, but up close and personal may be the most confused. It doesn't know what it wants to say. This is probably because, like many of us, the filmmakers don't like what the media's become, but can't resist being in on the action. The movie keeps shouting that TV culture is hollow and corrupt, then whispers in our ear, "But isn't it glamorous?"
John Powers is the film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. Our intern is Nate Hardy. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.